The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Fueled by a contaminated supply of street drugs, the overdose crisis in North America continues to claim lives at a record rate. The CDC released data recently for the 12-month period ending November 30, 2021. They project a final count of 106,854 deaths for that period. Fentanyl, benzodiazepines, xylazine, other novel psychoactive substances. The drug war is failing more horrifically than ever. And it's not only adults who are dying. Young people are dying, too, and in growing numbers. According to new research, adolescent deaths from overdose climbed from 518 in 2010 to 1,146 lives lost in 2021. Use rates among young people in the U.S. were stable in that period. This isn't about increased use. It's a toxic drug supply. To learn more, I spoke recently with UCLA's Joe Friedman, co-author of a research letter published April 12, 2022 in JAMA, entitled Trends in Drug Overdose Deaths Among U.S. Adolescents, January 2010 to June 2021.
My name is Joe Friedman. I am an addiction researcher at UCLA. I'm also an MD-PhD student at UCLA. Basically, we found that after decades of low and stable overdose trends among teens, for the first time in 2020 and 2021, teens are starting to die from drug overdoses at precipitous rates. This is especially concerning because for decades, teens have been insulated from rises in overdoses that we've seen among adults. And all of a sudden, this is starting to change. I'm particularly worried about these findings because what we've seen in other parts of the population is that once overdose deaths start to rise, they tend to continue to do so. And so situations that get bad usually, unfortunately, continue to get worse and worse. So these are the early days of these trends for teens, and it's a really important time for intervention. I think it's also important to note that teen drug use rates are at historic lows. So this is not coming from more teens using drugs. It's rather that drug use is becoming more dangerous. And that's because illicitly manufactured fentanyls, which have historically been sold in powders as counterfeit heroin, are now starting to be sold in counterfeit pills that look like OxyContin and Percocet, Xanax, and prescription drugs like that. And teens may not be aware of how risky these pills can be. So we know from surveys that teens have always been very unlikely to report experimenting with heroin and other powder drugs, but they're much more likely to report experimenting with pills. And so these prescription pills are becoming much more dangerous. And this is causing the start of a really kind of large magnitude tragedy among teens that we really need to get ahead of.
We keep hearing in terms of a response to the overdose crisis, we keep hearing about expanding treatment and making it possible for people with an addiction to get more treatment. But it doesn't sound like you're talking about a population that's addicted.
That's exactly right, Doug. I'm glad you brought that up. With teens, the story is a little different than with adults. Of course, some teens do develop substance use disorders, and those teens need extra support. We're not doing enough of that. But much of what we're seeing with teens is really just experimentation. It's not people who have what we would call a substance use disorder. And so this issue is really a lot more about educating teens in an accurate way about the risks of drug use. So it's very clear that all of our efforts to tell kids to, quote, just say no, have failed, right? Even though teen drug use is at historic lows, we're still seeing 40% of 12th graders reporting having tried an illicit substance at some point in their life. And so what this means is that no matter what we do, teens will inevitably experiment with some drugs. And in what we need to focus our efforts on for the future is teaching them, giving them accurate information about which drugs are more dangerous. And so teens should be told that although most Americans will eventually try an illicit drug, if they can wait and postpone trying drugs till their 20s, we know that is associated with much better outcomes on average. So if teens can wait till their 20s, they're much less likely to develop chaotic drug use that might really have a negative effect on their life. If they are going to experiment, then alcohol and cannabis, though they're not risk-free, they have much lower risk of death, right, of fatal overdose, because those drugs have never been found to be contaminated with fentanyls. And I think teens already know that powders are very risky, but we need to reinforce that and also teach them that pills are now also becoming kind of the riskiest category. And so it's important that they realize that if they're buying a pill or a powder on the street, it's very likely to be contaminated with fentanyl. So what that means is they should make sure that their friends or are never using pills alone. If there's a group of people, making sure that someone is not using and can call 911 should there be a problem. And ideally, also, I think teens should be taught about naloxone, and we need to have naloxone in schools and given out, because opioid overdoses are fully reversible if naloxone is on hand. It's an easy solution. The U.S. overdose crisis is the largest magnitude overdose crisis in recorded history. This is an unprecedented crisis, and we need to be recruiting teens to be part of the solution. And part of that means knowing about naloxone, having it on hand, to save anyone who they may come across who's in the middle of an overdose. And, increasingly, that person might be one of their friends or another teen. And so part of this is about kind of creating a culture of accurate knowledge about drugs, knowledge about how to stay safe. And unfortunately, that has to start with teens because they're now being really heavily affected.
Joe, thank you so much.
Thank you, Doug.
That was my interview with Joe Friedman. He's an addictions researcher, an MD, PhD student at UCLA, where he's currently completing a PhD in the social medicine track of the Medical Informatics Program in collaboration with the Center for Social Medicine. He's also a co-author of a research letter published April 12, 2022 in JAMA entitled Trends in Drug Overdose Deaths Among U.S. Adolescents, January 2010 to June 2021. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. I wanted to learn more about overdose deaths, about recovery, about harm reduction, so I reached out to a friend at the Drug Policy Alliance, Dr. Sheila Vaccaria.
I am Sheila Vaccaria, the Deputy Director of the Department of Research and Academic Engagement at the Drug Policy Alliance.
Now, Sheila, there's a couple of things I wanted to speak to you about, but in particular, there's a research letter that was published April 12th in the journal JAMA. It was entitled Trends in Drug Overdose Deaths Among U.S. Adolescents, January 2010 to June 2021. The authors found that back in 2010, there had been 518 deaths attributed to overdose among adolescents in the U.S. That rate remained stable through 2019. But then in 2020, deaths had increased to 954. And then in 2021, that number actually climbed to 1,146 adolescents dead from overdose. Now, I've spoken with a couple of the co-authors, Joe Friedman and Morgan Godwin. What are your thoughts?
Well, like them and like most people who read this study, I'm absolutely heartbroken. It's devastating. We're 20 years into this crisis and we've lost over a million lives to overdose. And it is absolutely heartbreaking to see annual numbers continue to climb. And now to hear we're losing our young people as well. It's absolutely devastating. And it makes you think, what is it about what we're doing that isn't enough? What are we doing wrong? What needs to change? Those of us who've been trying to raise the alarm on overdose deaths have been trying to get people to act, right? To pass laws grounded in public health, expand access to harm reduction and treatment. And I hope that this mobilizes some people to think about the strategies that we need to scale up if we really want to save lives.
the traditional responses over the in the U.S. over the years have been more law enforcement, more just say no kind of messages directed toward youth, and more adult treatment beds. It strikes me that that's not really going to do anything when it comes to certainly, well, at all, really, but especially when it comes to adolescent ODs.
Yeah, the impact of any of these strategies can only go so far, right? Because abstinence only is effective insofar as people remain abstinent. It's when people do experiment or you know, use recreationally, or even, you know, are out there using while they're in their active addiction, when those messages are thrown out the window, and where are the tools and strategies and skills that we could give them to learn how to navigate those situations, to learn how to navigate risk, make safer choices. So, you know, treatment is great for those who are motivated for it. And we should always think about like how to make sure that treatment is available and accessible and on demand for those who want it. But really this just this really highlights to all of us though, that we are not arming our young people with the right information. You know, so many of these lives could have been saved if young people got better education around drug mixing, understanding how to navigate the drug supply. You know, there's reason to think that perhaps some of these young people thought they were buying prescription pills on the underground market, but potentially that those were actually pressed pills, counterfeit pills that might have been cut with other drugs such as fentanyl. And, you know, many of these young people might have naively thought that they were actually getting the pharmaceutical supply. There's a likelihood as well that some of these young people might have been mixing or using multiple drugs together, not realizing the risk. And it's heartbreaking to think that there are young people who might have actually been there at the scene of an overdose and not known how to react, how to help, how to intervene. And, you know, what we can say is that all of this education can be provided in a developmentally appropriate way. All of these things can be taught to young people. You know, naloxone, the overdose reversal medication, is easy to administer and easy to train in and incredibly safe. So on the one hand, it's absolutely devastating. But on the other hand, we do know what works. And maybe this is a reason for us to scale up in doing what works.
Now, of course, you recently hosted a Twitter chat about that research, Joe and Morgan and another of the co-authors. I got to say, you know, the DPA's Department of Research and Academic Engagement, you've been producing some great content the last few years, just some really, really excellent webinars. And while I've got you here, I want to thank you and DPA for that. I mean, these have been tremendously useful and informative. And thank goodness you've been doing them online and posting them. This knowledge, these perspectives that you're sharing are invaluable. I mean, thanks to technology, people anywhere can learn, and they can share that knowledge, and hopefully people will act on what they've learned. So talk to me about these webinars you've been doing, and do you have any coming up that are of interest?
Yeah. So, you know, when we, you know, in the pre-COVID days, these used to be events that we would largely host in person. They're called Drug Researchers Roundtables. Oftentimes, when we would invite folks who were visiting New York or working and stationed in New York to talk to our community of students, academics, people who use drugs, harm reduction providers, treatment providers, and you name it, to come talk about their research in a way that was accessible to the public, and typically on issues that DPA is interested or working on. And one of the, you know, blessings in disguise that came along with COVID was the fact that we could easily shift these to the virtual kind of modalities. And if anything, it broadened the number and the types of people we could invite, because you didn't have to be in New York City to speak, but then it also meant that we could actually engage far more people in attending these events. And so thank you so much for recognizing that and for joining us for those, because we are thrilled to be able to do this. You know, we continue to also host webinars around skills building for making research more publicly accessible, and also for engaging people with lived experience into research. And one of those series is actually coming up, and it's kicking off on Monday the 18th. It's a 4-part series that we are hosting to engage researchers in thinking beyond community-based participatory research to community-driven participatory research, meaning actually even before conceptualizing study designs among researchers, really to talk to community members and people with lived experience about what are their research needs, what are their questions that need to be answered, what are trends that they're seeing that they need more evidence or research to be able to document so that something will be done. And so this four-part series is really exciting. It's in collaboration with the Urban Survivors Union and also with the Network of Drug Researchers with Lived Experience. So the first one is kicking off on Monday the 18th at 4:30 Eastern, and we'll have four of those between then and May that we're really looking forward to. We're also hosting a book talk with Dr. Donna Murch about her new book, Asada Taught Me. And it's more about a series of essays that she wrote in response to, conceptualizations of racial capitalism within the context of, the movement for Black Lives. And it's a really exciting book. We're looking forward to that event. That's actually a week from today. And we're recording today on the 14th. So it's the 21st. And then we've also got a two-day conference on the systems of surveillance that have been built in the name of the drug war and the ways in which mass surveillance has actually subjected our populations to like undue monitoring and, punitive interventions and all of this being kind of an intersectional issue just beyond drug policy, but also in terms of child welfare. So we're really excited about that. That'll be on the 28th and 29th of this month. So yeah, there's plenty on the docket.
This is terrific. And now you'll be, of course, posting these things for people who can't attend at the time that they're going on. You'll still be posting these at your YouTube site. Where remind me again your web address so people can people can find this.
Sure. So you can learn more about the Drug Policy Alliance, the organization itself, by going to drugpolicy.org. Now, if you want to visit our YouTube channel, we actually have two YouTube channels, which hold various archived webinars and events and conferences. So you can, when you go to YouTube, you can look up Drug Policy Alliance, and you'll see that we have a separate channel also called DPA Voices, where a lot of our events are also archived. So we've definitely tried to make everything accessible to folks, whether they've been able to make it or not. And we know that like folks definitely tend to tune in when they miss events. So yeah. And about our social media as well. Sorry about that.
Please, yes.
Folks can follow us, Drug Policy Alliance on Facebook. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram and TikTok at drugpolicy.org. And my department, the Department of Research and Academic Engagement, is on Twitter at Drug Policy Nerd.
Another thing I want to thank you for, and I'm glad you're here so I could do that, is that a few years ago, I interviewed you for a show I was doing on the subject of recovery. And I don't know if I mentioned it in that. I'm pretty sure that I didn't. So I'm a former cocaine user. Now, I've slipped a few times, but I have managed to not use for about the past decade. About a year and a half ago, I started to cut back on alcohol use. Then last year, in September, it was around the anniversary of my father's death, I decided to stop using alcohol entirely. My dad had been an alcoholic, well, bullying, abusive drunk is what I refer to him as, but enough of me. I'm now what I half-jokingly refer to as Oregon sober. I mean, I still use caffeine products. As we were speaking before, I'm so into tea, and I was a coffee achiever back when that was a thing. And I still smoke weed. That's the stuff folks who are fans of 18th century Swedish naturalists refer to as cannabis. And hey, not going to make that joke. And hey, if you can't, and hey, who better to listen to than some old white European? Sorry. I'll probably cut that out. No, I won't. Marijuana. So now, can you... The late Dan Big had a very simple phrase that it just keeps resounding for me, and that's any positive change. Can you talk to me for just our listeners and me for just a moment in general about recovery and any positive change?
In this day and age of black and white thinking, either or, abstinent or chaotic use, we've got to understand that there is a middle ground. And for a lot of people, that can include their path to recovery. And as long as people feel like there's a middle ground for them, whether it's cutting down frequency, cutting down amounts, substituting from the drug that has gotten them in the most problems to one that maybe hasn't caused any problems for them just yet, I think all of those steps towards health and wellness don't often get the recognition or acknowledgement that they need. But I think that they are such an important component of how harm reductionists think of progress and change and wellness and recovery. And so I'm so thrilled and congratulations to you for making the changes that you did. And I think that, so much of how we want to look at people's relationships with substances or how people engage in certain behaviors is based on an either or mentality. Either you are or you aren't. Either it's problematic or you're not doing it at all. When the reality is that all of us live in that area of gray in the middle, and all of us are trying to navigate, having a substance in our life or while still, trying to manage the complications of our day-to-day lives. And so, that's where any positive change comes from.
Now, what question should I have asked you that I haven't?
I think when it comes to the JAMA study, just to go back to the study for a second, one of the most revealing parts of the findings to both the researchers and myself and a lot of folks who read the study is that this dramatic increase in overdose deaths among our young people didn't happen at a time where simultaneously we saw that rates of their use was necessarily going up dramatically in any way, shape, or form. And I think that, it should force us all to kind of for a second stop and think about the fact that if it wasn't that more young people were out there using drugs, but more people were dying, that in some ways, we have to stop and look and say that it was because of the drug supply. And what we know is that, as I said before, 20 years into this overdose crisis, and we're only losing more lives per year rather than seeing any sort of stabilization or decrease in these rates. And, growing portions of these deaths, the most recent data we have now on a national level, just a few days ago, the CDC released provisional death counts as of November 2021. So in the 12 months between November 2020 and November 2021, we lost over 100,000 people to overdose death. And over 70% of those involved fentanyl or fentanyl analogs. And we saw a similar trend in these young youth numbers as well, that over 70% of those young people died with fentanyl in their system. And so we have to acknowledge that even the occasional recreational social user or that very small percentage of people with addictions are those most at risk because they're engaging with the drug market. But it's not that more people are engaging with the drug market. It's that the existing people engaging with the drug market are more at risk of death. And that our harsher penalties aren't working. In 2018, then President Donald Trump used an executive order opportunity to actually make a class-wide decision about all fentanyl and fentanyl-related substances and to deem them all Schedule I drugs, subjecting them then to harsher penalties and, folks in possession to harsher federal penalties. And this was even after nearly 45 states had already passed their own ordinances or laws to make harsher penalties towards fentanyl and fentanyl analogs. And at that time in 2018, when we decided to do this, fentanyl was only involved in 50% of deaths. And so here we are 3 years later with Biden extending this class-wide scheduling temporarily, and deaths involving these drugs only seem to be going up. And we will have an opportunity, at the end of this year, again, to say, let's let this class-wide scheduling expire, because if anything, it's simply making harsher penalties for a drug that has already infiltrated our markets. In some ways, the toothpaste is out of the tube, right? And so at this point, it's really about scaling up harm reduction, scaling up treatment, but also thinking of those other social determinants of health that are affecting a lot of the adults who use drugs. And increasing the risks associated with their drug use, right? What are we doing to meet the economic and social needs of our communities? What are we doing to increase access to housing? Drug arrest rates have not gone down dramatically, in the past several years. They've remained relatively stable. And so we have to stop and think, what is it about our current approaches that aren't working and that maybe we need to be shifting and allocating resources and more energy towards strategies to help keep people safe?
And any closing thoughts for my listeners?
When you come check out drugpolicy.org, please check out our innovative one-of-a-kind curriculum called Safety First, which is the first of its kind harm reduction-based drug prevention education program for young high schoolers, young students and high schoolers, that gives developmentally and age-appropriate information about drugs and how to identify the signs of an overdose and how to respond effectively. It's already being implemented in schools across the country. Your school district can be next. One of the key findings that we found from running our pilot studies was that students who completed Safety First were more able to, after completing it, to be able to say they knew how to identify an overdose and what to do in case of an overdose. So it's just as simple as that. And please look into Safety First.
Sheila, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was part of my conversation with Sheila Vakharia, PhD, Deputy Director of the Department of Research and Academic Engagement for the Drug Policy Alliance. The Drug User Liberation Front, along with the Canadian Association of People Who Use Drugs, the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, the Western Aboriginal Harm Reduction Society, and others, held a news conference April 13th to discuss the need for bold action to address the drug poisoning and overdose crisis. Here's Eris Nix with the Drug User Liberation Front.
Today marks a grim day, 6 years into a public health crisis, 6 years without answers, 6 years of hearing we're sorry from people in power, and 6 years of our friends, family, and community members dying to the pallid death of overdose. Things have been difficult for many of us, and I think it's important for us to use this day to remember all those we have lost, as well as an opportunity to reflect on the colonial, racist, and archaic drug policy that is failing and killing our friends, family, and loved ones. This policy, the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act, needs to be repealed, replaced, reformatted, thrown in the trash. We cannot wait another 6 years to change what is happening. Every year, we lose more and more folks. The coroner just released in British Columbia the death numbers for February. They did not release these with any pomp and circumstance. They did not release them with any good news. On this, the grim anniversary of the 6 year of a public health crisis, it is us, people who use drugs, who have come together to protect our own communities. And to this end, the Drug User Liberation Front has distributed 17 grams of cocaine, heroin, and methamphetamine tested rigorously across the province to various drug user groups. And today you will hear from some of the folks that received that supply. And I must stress as my final point that what we need is regulation of a deregulated market. You would not see alcohol toxicity grow to the point where it is killing 10,000 people over 6 years. Alcohol is the most dangerous drug of all, yet it is regulated. Why do we regulate it? Because we know prohibition fails. And much the same as a prohibition of alcohol, so too is a prohibition of drugs.
That was Eris Nix with the Drug User Liberation Front in Vancouver, BC. Find them on the web at dulf.ca. And for now, that's it. Thank you for joining us. This has been Century of Lies. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. For now, this is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.